Porkchop Express and take his advice on a dark and stormy night, all right? When some wild-eyed, 8-foot tall maniac grabs your neck, taps the back of your favorite head up against a barroom wall, and he looks you crooked in the eye and he asks you if you've paid your dues, well, you just stare that big sucker right back in the eye and you remember what old Jack Burton always says at a time like that. Have you paid your dues, Jack? Yes, sir, the check is in the mail.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Pop Culture Ninja. I'm Nathan, joined with Nathan. How you doing, Nathan?
Doing great.
Hopefully this works out for us. We had a technical issue not too long ago, so we'll see how this goes. It's good to be back in the studio again. The last time we recorded was our Spielberg's Fantastical Worlds episode 4, and we had done that just before 4th of July when we had done our review of the BFG. So we're back in, ready to rock and roll and get these podcasts underway again. So excited about that. Today we are looking forward to talking about Big Trouble in Little China. But going even a little more than that, we're looking to talk about just kind of that 80s action flicky kind of slapstick genre that really there were quite a few movies that came out of that time period that were like that. And while we're going to focus on Big Trouble in Little China, we really have quite a few things that quite a few other movies that we want to discuss as well. Want to start off by saying, Nathan, you, myself, and a friend of ours, Jason Lovelace, who unfortunately could not be here for the recording of this one, wanted to get him on here so bad. But just didn't work out timing-wise. We'll have him on again in the future, or we'll have him on at some time in the future. We went and saw this, what was it, 3 weeks ago now?
Just about. We saw it at the Senator Theater in Baltimore, down on York Road, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is a great big old-style movie house mm-hmm. from the late 30s. And they've kept it more or less in running condition yeah. all these years. There's been some back and forth with it, and it changed hands a few years back. But it's now been up and running for a while, and they've started doing something where they've gone back and they're doing revivals of movies, various movies, and they do a series. So about every week there's a new movie. Mm-hmm. So Jason brought to our attention the Big Trouble in Little China,
yeah.
which if you know, is our log line as we go off of the of Pop Culture Ninja, and the backsplash on our Twitter page is Big Trouble in Little China. So it's really cool to have an opportunity to go and see it in the big screen, because I saw it as a kid, as I imagine most people did, on home video
yeah.
in like the mid-90s, 86 or 87, when it came on VHS. And when I'm looking at it, it really doesn't look like it made a lot of money when it was released. So I don't think a lot of people did see it in the theater. But of course, since then, it's become a cult classic. And it certainly is one of those sort of, as you put it, cheesy action comedy flicky sort yeah. of movies that the 80s were kind of well known for. But seeing it at a theater was a very interesting experience, because obviously with these revivals, just last week they did one for Lawrence of Arabia, and mm-hmm. you get a lot of people coming out who are really fans of these movies. No,
yes.
9 times out of 10, they own these movies on Blu-ray.
Yep.
I'm sure you and I both
yeah.
have Big Trouble in Little China in our collection, just like I have Lawrence of Arabia in my collection. Now, obviously, the audience for Lawrence of Arabia was a little different than the audience for Big Trouble in Little China, who's sort of quoting
yes.
all the lines. You could kind of, no pun intended there, you could feel the electricity in the air sort of right before it began. And Jason, his brother, was with us too.
Mm-hmm.
He was down. He was so amped up for it that he sort of just brought the energy up a few degrees in our row there. So it was really cool to see it in that setting and on a
yeah.
really big screen in a kind of old-fashioned movie house where, again, usually reserved for this big sort of epic movies. It was neat to see something a little goofy that, to be honest, I mostly associate with television because I never saw it in the bigger format. It was cool to see it in that that perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nathan, let's talk about what makes again, we're going to discuss some other movies, but we are focusing on Big Trouble in Little China. What made this such a great cult classic? Because as you said, really didn't seem to do well when it came out to theaters, but it's something that's really grown with people and stuck with them. And, you know, as we were in the theater, like you said, people are just, you know, they're quoting. And it's like when you bring a bunch of people over and you watch The Princess Bride, you just can't help but quote a movie like this because it's got so many memorable things to it. But what do you think makes it so memorable?
Well, you know, and you just mentioned The Princess Bride, which is interesting because it came out just about the same time, a year or so later, I think. And with The Princess Bride and with Big Trouble in Little China, they're both of them are in a way sort of mashups or takeoffs of fantasy films that in the 80s, fantasy movies really got lodged in this like arena of self-seriousness a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, movies like Conan the Barbarian. I mean, there was a silliness to them to a degree, but these sword and sorcery movies started taking themselves to a degree very serious, even though a lot of times they were very shoddy, very silly, and kind of ridiculous. And it's probably a good time, too, to sort of lay out for anyone who doesn't know or who maybe even needs a refresher, maybe hasn't seen Big Trouble in Little China in a very long time, what exactly the plot is and how it all came to be. One of the things that's interesting, and I, as a child watching it, I never realized, is that it was a movie from John Carpenter. Mm-hmm. Because as a kid, when I heard the name John Carpenter in my house, I usually steered clear of when that video was being played because nine times out of ten, it was a horror movie.
Yes.
Halloween.
Yep.
I made the mistake once of as a young child falling asleep on the couch, and I guess my parents didn't take me up to bed. So I was there when The Thing was on. And I, as many children from that era probably remember that scene where the alien creature is in the dogs and they start to mutate and arms and mouths are coming out of places arms and mouths shouldn't come out of. And just very terrifying. Also with Kurt Russell. So The Thing, Escape from New York, which was more of a sci-fi action movie, but Christine, the Stephen King killer car movie.
Yep.
So all of these come out. Now, in the midst of all that growing up, I also see movies like Starman, which I remember really enjoying, which is a much more gentle sort of romance sci-fi road trip movie with Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen. And that also is a John Carpenter movie. But there was a point in this in the mid-80s where he started to play around a little bit more with his style. So he wasn't just making horror movies. Mm-hmm. He was trying different things in different genres. One of those was Starman, and another one of them was Big Trouble in Little China. So what I think, if you're asking what is one of the things that makes it a cult classic, there's a couple elements. I think one of them is that it felt fresh. The same thing that kept it from being a hit when it came out, being that people couldn't easily identify what it was. A lot of critics who normally I think later on in later years when genre movies became more of a thing, a lot of critics that would normally hail something like that as being original and fresh didn't know what to make of it. I mean, Roger Ebert, for example, usually was a big fan of these kinds of things, but he didn't know, well, was it supposed to be a Western or is it supposed to be a sort of 80s action flick, or is it a fantasy movie? Is it a Chinese fantasy movie? They couldn't decide. I think all the things that allowed it not to have an audience originally are the very things that allowed it to gain an ongoing audience that just grew over the decades, being that when people encountered it, I think if you think back to the first time you saw it, I think back to the first time I saw it, what was interesting was it did feel fresh and different. I was seeing things that normally were reserved for other little more serious movies, creepy magic and monsters and things like that. But there was a joking undertone to the whole movie that gave it some balance and some weight. And I was watching a lot of little pieces of things mixed together. The 80s was big for genre splicing. And you would see this just a few years later. Big Trouble in Little China fails to hit because it's sort of aimed at adults in a way, even though I don't think the movie itself is, but I'm sure it was marketed towards teenagers and adults. A few years later, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the little miniseries that comes on television, is not that far different from Big Trouble in Little China, like narratively, I think, if you look at it. There's even a scene where both of them involve the heroes being tied up in a room while a creepy little dude cackles and explains his plans for world domination.
Right.
But all the same things that were appealing and enticing about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, I think, is in Big Trouble in Little China. And I don't think it's surprising that the cult audience that's sitting there enjoying this movie a few nights ago, 30 years down the road now, were probably 7 or 8 or 9 when they saw it. So I think the other secret is that Big Trouble in Little China is almost like a kid's movie.
Yeah.
In the sense that Jack Burton is kind of this American hero archetype. Like, he thinks he's John Wayne, but he's more like Don Knotts, and in a sense. And he's kind of like a giant child. I think a movie that's very similar to Big Trouble in Little China is, I mean, you wouldn't think of it. A lot of people link Big Trouble in Little China and The Golden Child because they have very similar, yes, like Oriental mysticism coming in with a kind of jokey main character. And Victor, yep, Wong plays a creepy, yeah, old man in both of them. And, but I think in a lot of ways, Big Trouble in Little China bears a lot of similarities, at least thematically, to something like The Goonies, like a, yeah, kind of adventure that's aimed kind of squarely at this kind of kid sensibility. Even though the difference, of course, is everybody in Big Trouble in Little China is an honorary adult.
Right.
At least they appear to be.
Right, right.
So I think that that's part of it. I think the audience that it has now, most of them largely encountered it when they were kids. It's a kind of kids movie hiding in adult clothing. Mm. I think that was a harder thing to pitch in 1986 than it is now.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think, you know, a lot of parents at that point, they were looking at who's the person who's directing this, who's the person who is behind this. And so when you have John Carpenter, who, you know, is you know, the master of horror at that point, I think a lot of parents were steering clear of it. Now, you know, you and I have both talked. Our parents were probably more similar in vein to, you know, being more liberal to the things we were allowed to watch as children than even I know some of my friends were, you know, and things that they were allowed to watch. So I think, you know, my father just being a huge movie buff and loving movies and wanting to share that with his children, this was one that, being a big kid himself, he just loved and enjoyed and shared with us. And so you're right, growing up, that nostalgia, you know, it was great going back and seeing it on the big screen, you know, 30 some years later. So,
and considering like all the things that sort of make it what it is.
Yeah.
So I think something else at the time that probably hindered it was the fact that, and it's harder for us to conceive of this, I think, in our current climate, movie-wise, like where we've come in the last 15 or 20 years with movies. Now, no one really thinks much about going to the theater to see a movie with subtitles.
Mm.
Yeah. It's just a thing that happens. But honestly, pre-Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and then I think around the same time, a movie called Brotherhood of the Wolf.
Yes.
That, that's its own podcast with martial artist Iroquois and yes, giant monsters and courtesan spies from the Vatican. But those movies were genre movies that were, when they were introduced into theaters, they did very well for what they were.
Mm-hmm.
And they started to make the idea of foreign films more palatable, at least to your general audience. There were a lot of us that already knew about foreign movies, that had been watching foreign movies for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon was one of the first foreign movies I remember going to the theater to see where I actually got a chance to watch it in the subtitled format. Even downtown, the Charles Theater, when it would play foreign films, mm-hmm, any kind of foreign film, it was very hard and it was very uncommon to be able to go to see one of these in theater without getting the American dub,
yeah,
of the movie, because, yeah, theaters were so hesitant to play subtitles. The 80s was even more so like that. I remember one time my dad rented Akira Kurosawa's Ran. I don't think he knew what he had.
Mm.
And we started watching it, and he was like, how long we got to read this movie? I was like, for the whole thing.
Yeah.
But that was not a very common thing, to have subtitles at a theater, or even a movie that was had been dubbed,
right,
in theaters.
Right.
So most of your exposure to this sort of thing, particularly what Carpenter was trying to tap into, which was a Chinese action market, the kind of Chinese chop-socky movies, mm-hmm, the stuff that Tarantino is referencing in Kill Bill years later.
Sure. And,
I mean,
sure,
Jackie Chan doesn't even become a popular presence over here statewide until like 1996, thereabouts. Yeah. And that's the point when the tide starts to turn and all of these kind of geeks are like ourselves that were watching this,
right,
stuff and getting it when we could, renting it from Blockbuster, the one tattered copy they had,
yeah,
again, usually dubbed, and knowing and figure out who Jet Li was and who,
yep,
these guys were, and Shokasugi and Sonny Chiba and all these names that nobody now people know in a niche,
right,
niche environment, but they didn't really know then. And with a movie like this, Carpenter's trying to tap into this Chinese mysticism, this Chinese fantasy. He's trying, mm-hmm, to bring a different kind of fantasy to the screen. And I just don't think people got it. I don't even know that people were even aware it was Carpenter. You mentioned
sure,
that.
Yeah.
I think the issue was less that parents or anybody were making a conscious choice to stay away from it. I think they looked at it and were like, okay, next. You know, whatever else was playing in the multiplex at the time
sure.
was more appealing. And I haven't really gone back and looked. I'm not sure how well The Golden Child did commercially compared. They are very similar movies.
Right.
I don't... Golden Child, of course, has Eddie Murphy as
sure.
the main character, the American character who gets caught up in the mysticism.
Yeah.
The other thing, of course, with Big Trouble in Little China, I'll kind of shoot it to you, Nathan, to kind of talk a little bit about the plot.
Sure.
Is the main character, the
yeah.
Kurt Russell,
yeah.
Jack Burton character.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Jack Burton is just one of those... more and more, I am loving the flawed characters. The heroes that aren't don't get me wrong, I love one of my biggest complaints of all time was Superman was a flawed character and just that bothered me in the more recent incarnations of Superman. Superman was always the character just larger than life, above the muck and mire of humanity, and I love that about him. But one of the things that was appealing about Jack Burton was he was an every day kind of dude. You know, he was out there, he was driving his truck, he was gambling, he was drinking, you know, he was hitting on women, and he was doing it in just such an out there way that it's like you just can't help but laugh at him, because this is almost like your buddy who is trying to hit on the girls and you're just like, no, there's no way. And you watch it happen and it's like a train wreck. You know something bad's going to happen. You know it's going to be horrible and you can't avert your eyes because it's going to be that good. And that's what we see in Jack Burton, I believe, is just, you know, he arrives on the scene, he's talking into a CB radio, you know, it's all in the reflexes, you know, and just... He comes on strong in the movie and just you can't take your eyes off him. He's just that charismatic and that funny.
When he does show up, like you say, he's the very first scene of the movie, he's there. And we've had Kurt Russell as action hero in The Thing and Escape from New York. And he's been in a few other movies at that time. But the character that you get in Big Trouble in Little China, like you say, he kind of thinks he's Superman. He kind of thinks he's John Wayne,
right.
But he's very far off from that.
Right.
And I think that what is fortunate for the movie now, what was maybe unfortunate for the movie at the time, is I feel like John Carpenter really did examine everything he had to work with here and was really trying to make a movie that would bring audiences in and transplant them not just in this world of Chinese mythology and mm-hmm. Chinese fantasy, but into a world of Chinese Americans
yeah.
and how Chinese culture has permeated as a part of American culture. It was, I mean, Chinese and Japanese culture was sort of coming to a certain kind of pop culture prominence in the 80s,
yeah.
but in certain yeah. ways, in kind of weird junky sort of ways, you know.
Sure.
You couldn't really go around the corner, particularly here in Maryland, you couldn't go around the corner and not see a Kim's Karate or insert any sort of karate school, you
sure.
know.
Sure.
It would be right next to the Asian restaurant with the flaming red dragon neon lights, you know, passing a video store with Bruce Lee posters and David Carradine and whatnot plastered all over the place. I mean, all of this stuff was everywhere, but it was very kind of kitschy, and you know, every dude thought he was Bruce Lee. There were a ton of guys walking around with mullets white beaters like Jack Burton, and thinking they were like, you know, martial art kings, you know, my fists are deadly weapons. But to Jack Burton's credit, he doesn't tout his martial arts skills that much in the movie. But what's interesting is he comes in and he is really very much like a child to all of this, not just in his mentality, but in how he interacts with the fantastical.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting in the very beginning when he's given that little speech
yeah.
and he's talking, he says something that's interesting because he's talking up the fact that, well, I've been all over the world and I just, you know, it's hard to argue that there isn't something greater out there. He's trying to put on the fact that, yeah, you know, I definitely believe there's something out there. He wants to leave himself open to the idea of some grand thing, but he's very vague about it. He's like, it's out there somewhere. So the minute he starts coming up against all these sort of larger than life fantastical conceits, he's completely out of his element and out of the water. He kind of wants to believe, he has no idea what to believe, and when he gets thrown in the middle of it, he's just out of his league. He's just a kind of typical consumer American who
right.
thinks he's the king of his own story, and suddenly he isn't. And it's interesting because...
Where's my truck?
Yeah. And actually, we talk about the opening scene being him in the truck driving. It actually isn't. And I always forget about it. I forgot about that when we went to the theater to see
it.
That the opening scene actually is... It doesn't involve Jack Burton at all.
Right.
And I was reading that one of the reasons that the scene is in there is because... They were concerned, like test audiences were not reacting right, and they didn't think that people were grasping that Jack Burton was the hero of the story.
Right.
Like they're like, because in a way he's not. Dennis Dunn's Wang Chi is the guy who does most of everything. He's the guy who's trying to get his girl back. He's trying to get Mao Yin back.
Yep.
And he is the Chinese guy who is friends with Jack Burton.
Right.
Jack Burton comes into the story via Wang, and he's kind of just always playing second fiddle to him. Like while Wang is beating up a ton of guys with his various martial arts skills and flying through the air, Burton has either fallen down on the ground, or he's got his knife stuck in his shoe, or there's a scene where he shoots the roof and the concrete just falls on his head and immobilizes him for like 90% of the big battle. He's constantly doing stuff like that. So they wanted to have a scene where Victor Wong's Egg Shen literally tells the lawyer who's interviewing them, no, Jack Burton is a hero.
Right.
He saved us. And that was the whole reason that scene exists, at least supposedly, was to reinforce the fact that Jack Burton is the hero of the story, even though I think Carpenter and everyone else knows better. He's a character we like and we react to, but he's not really the hero, which is kind of why we like him. We kind of like the fact that he's out of his depth, that he is reacting the same way we would react to these fantastical elms. He tries to put on a brave face.
Right.
He tries to be the hero, but that's about all he really does until the very end. When he finally gets his moment, his face is smeared in lipstick. Where he got from kissing the girl about 5 minutes earlier. He runs around with that lipstick on his face for the last 5-6 minutes of the movie.
Now, as we're looking at this, agreed that, there was something that just people didn't know how to categorize this movie. Another movie that I'd almost classify in this is Remo Williams, The Adventure Begins. You have Fred Ward playing that, and then you have Joel Grey, who plays Chun, the little Korean dude. And you get that same feel, though, like this guy who's supposed to be this hero and be doing these awesome things, and really he's a stumbling baboon, as I think Chen would call him. He just tromps around in the woods like a cow. what is it that you think, again, just kind of looking at this broadly, what would really be the relatability factor of these types of movies? Because we could go on and on. You have this one, you have Remo Williams, you have Evil Dead, or Army of Darkness really is the more slapstick kind of, I would say, closer. Evil Dead 2 kind of gets that way, but really Army of Darkness is the one that is, really just out there. And
I think Army of Darkness is probably the most benign of the three. It's definitely the goofiest.
Yeah.
I think Evil Dead 2 is even more slapsticky, and then it's almost purely... It's got the creepy stuff left, but it's almost purely like Three Stooges. Like, there's whole moments in the middle of Evil Dead where it's just Bruce Campbell being beaten with various things. I think it goes back there's some stuff going on where we talked about Jack Burton sort of having a little bit of a resemblance in the way he tries to talk like he's John Wayne. Know what I mean? We talked about the guys pretending like they're Bruce Lee back in the 80s. Well, Burton is not really all that interested in the Chinese experience or any of the cultural elements, really. They're sort of like a kind of novelty to him. I love when the guy's like, well, China is here, Mr. He's like, what does that even mean?
Right.
China is here. Which he's got a point. What does that mean?
Right.
But at the same time, I think that's what Carpenter is kind of saying through his movie is, China is here. They are here. They've been here for a while.
Right.
And are we paying attention to everything they have to offer? I think we can go back to that in a minute, where I think what Carpenter's really trying to tell is a melding of American folklore,
yeah,
American folktales, and Chinese fantasy, and showing how they both belong together now because of how our American culture isn't a single thing. It doesn't belong to white cowboys anymore. It's interesting, too, to consider that, before we get back to the Remo Williams connection, if you consider that, I didn't know this initially, but it makes perfect sense. Big Trouble in Little China has always felt kind of weird to me in the sense that it doesn't feel like it obviously takes place in the 80s, but most of the plot line, you imagine the script, it doesn't feel like it does take place in the 80s. It could really take place just about anywhere.
Yes.
And in fact, the way that a lot of the characters interact with each other and the way that the Chinatown element is so set apart, you almost feel like it's happening more towards the turn of the century.
Mm.
And it turns out the original script was that way. The original script was a Western. Jack Burton was a cowboy, and he came into a town just like you would see in an old West setting.
Right.
And then these fantasy elements where the Chinese immigrants were involved, and that's how the story played out initially. I think it's probably more successful being set when it's set, but
yeah,
originally it was in that setting. Remo Williams is kind of same thing. I don't know. That was another movie that I don't think mostly everybody who knows it, and I think we are of a small group of people that know it, encountered it also on DVD, not DVD, on VHS back in the day. And it's another movie that taps into what at the time was a kind of fascination with Asian action films, and uses that to kind of jokingly kid at the main character. But I think we were dealing with, so the 70s was a time for very gritty, very dark action movies that had a sense of realism to them. There wasn't though we were getting that point, like the Dirty Harry movies, the Death Wish movies and things like that. Very grim, very serious action movies, which then begat the Schwarzenegger and Stallone movies, which had the same level of violence, the same intensity, but started to be a little goofy. Not always purposefully so, but eventually you got Schwarzenegger with his one-liner. So you sort of see this evolution from John Wayne and Gary Cooper and those sorts of heroes, and this evolution where we start to get a darker character, and then the kind of jokey version of that dark character, and then straight up the joke.
Right.
In the cases of guys, like I think the appeal of movies like Evil Dead, Big Trouble in Little China, Remo Williams, also a movie that was directed by the guy who worked on the script for Big Trouble in Little China, Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
Oh, yeah.
Are you familiar with this one?
Vaguely,
That'll be its own podcast. I mean, that movie has Peter Weller, who went on to be RoboCop.
Yes.
It has Jeff Goldblum. It has John Lithgow. It's got Clancy Brown. There are tons and tons of actors in this movie, and it is completely ridiculous. But again, it mixes a lot of that kind of, even the title Buckaroo Banzai, you literally have the Japanese connotation and the Western connotation in the title. And it's that same thing, a mashup of what was once it's hard for us too, because I don't think Westerns, we have never lived in a time, honestly, even the past 30 years, where Westerns were really, really popular.
Yeah.
But at one point they were a genre that just sort of that was almost a sure thing. You know, today I think a lot of people think a horror movie is a sure thing, genre-wise. And at a certain point in time, the Western was a sure thing.
Yeah.
Of course, in our time, even in the 80s, you have movies like Silverado and a movie here or there, Dances with Wolves, a little later in the 90s. And then, of course, you and I would probably point to, on the small screen, The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Yes.
With Bruce Campbell again, and playing sort of the... He a little less of a man-child. He was a little more of a legitimate hero.
Yeah.
But he was a matinee hero mixed with a kind of grown man who isn't comfortable in his skin.
Sure.
He's a character a kid can relate to. And again, there was a lot of that, too. James Hong, who plays Lo Pan in Big Trouble in Little China, shows up many times as a sort of Asian mentor to Briscoe County.
Yes.
So there was a lot of that going on, and it's interesting because a lot of the movies, and Evil Dead aside, though, it's interesting because you watch Evil Dead and you see a lot of the craziness going on, and a year before, a Chinese director, Chu Hark, did a movie called Chinese Ghost Story. Mm. And if you watch Chinese Ghost Story, you are literally watching Chinese Evil Dead.
Mm.
There's a scene where the characters, one of which is a rapping Taoist monk who has whole scenes where he just raps. And he and the main character are fighting a giant tongue, which is crawling in and out of the tree and trying to smack them down, and they have to stab it with their swords. And there's a lot of ghoulies and ghosts that jump up and like slapstick. So it's interesting to watch that movie because you can see the sort of connection. But again, these are movies that very few people would have seen,
right?
Other than that die-hard person who's going out of their way to see the late-night show at some art theater or something like that back in the 80s. So I don't think people start digging that stuff out till the 90s. So there's an element where I think what's happening is the American filmmakers are kind of kidding around with our own history, mm-hmm. in terms of the white, you know, savior hero character. And they were tapping into this thing and saying, hey, this is really cool. We've never seen this kind of thing before. It's not to our sensibility. How do we bring people into that? We need to bring them in with an America. We have to have the white character. So instead of just putting them in as a token character, they made them the buffoon.
Sort
of, in a sense, they were the sidekick, even though they were the top bill.
Right, right. Well, what I find is that, oddly enough, it works, though. I mean, you know, it's funny because today I think we've gotten into just an awkward place. And, you know, I'm not going to really expand on this too much, but there's so much sensitivity going on, particularly in film with race and, you know, making people look good and sound good and act a certain way and be a certain way. And, you know, we saw that this year's Academy Awards was filled with, you know, all sorts of issues. But what's funny is, like, you know, as a white person going and seeing Jack Burton, I don't feel offended, you know, going to see Fred Ward. You know, these guys, they're buffoonish. They're, you know, constantly falling over themselves and, you know, tripping over someone else to get to where they need to go. But, you know, they're amusing. And what I find great is that, you know, these are the guys that are relatable. You know, as much as I love Superman and I, you know, Captain America, those are just my two go-to superheroes. The ones who are uncompromising in their virtue and in, you know, morals. I love those guys. They're not the guys that I can ultimately relate to. Those are the guys that I want to be. Those are the guys that I aspire to. Jack Burton is the guy that I am. You know, Remo Williams is the guy that I am. And so for me, I find a sense of relatability in their characters that I love and enjoy.
Right. And I think when you talk about, you know, the PC and everything like that, and to be fair, of course, you know, if you are here in America watching movies, you've had 50, 60 years of white flawless heroes.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what's interesting about those two movies, particularly I think Big Trouble in Little China and a little bit with Golden Child. The problem with Golden Child is that the whole Chinese culture in Golden Child is kind of just there for like Eddie Murphy to rib on and riff on, which is okay. But Jack Burton doesn't really spend his whole of his time making fun of the Chinese culture, which I think is the big difference with Carpenter. He's just sort of in awe of it. Mm-hmm. And he wants to pick up on it and he wants to be involved. He wants to help to the degree that he can. So it's interesting because one of the first things he does is he slips into that, like, really caricaturish, buffoonish Henry Swanson character where it's like he's channeling Clark Griswold from the Vacation movies. And and what he's doing is he's going in to kind of surveil and case out the prostitution joint where he's looking for the green-eyed girl. And he's going in there like he wants to pick up a woman. And he's just this perfect caricature of kind of greasy, smarmy, American greed and creepiness a little bit, and who's just there to kind of – I mean, this is not who he is. It's his cover.
Right.
But you get this funny scene where you're essentially having the American creep come in to sort of exploit the Chinese culture. He just wants a piece of it.
Right.
Literally. And the rest of the time, he's basically just running around trailing the characters. What he does is he frees up the audience to realize that there is this very rich cast of characters, many of them Chinese actors, who kind of come to life and really bring the story to life. I mean, mm-hmm. Burton's good, but he wouldn't be very interesting if he didn't have this rich world to play off of.
Right.
I think that might be one of the things that's interesting to think is we never – if I had this character, particularly years later when Carpenter realizes that, okay, it was a success in a different sense.
Sure.
I would have thought that it would be time to roll him into Jack Burton goes – you know, to the moon or whatever, not to the moon. But you could have sent him on so many different adventures with so many different sorts of mythologies. But Carpenter never does. I mean, right. Which is probably smart. He is very effective being juxtaposed against this world, this Chinese underworld, literal underworld of fantasy. And I think that's interesting, too, because the fantasy worlds of the Chinese – that the Chinese fantasy that's presented in this movie is, on the surface, it does feel very much like the kind of things you would see in a comic book and stuff mm-hmm. like that. I don't think it delves deeply into the richness that is Chinese mythology, mm-hmm. but it gives us an idea and a concept of it. And it's interesting that the Chinese fantasy world is in constant flux, the one that's presented in the movie. It's a limbo where there can be a ghost who walks up and you can run him down with your truck. And the next time you see him, he's a creepy old man. And next time he's a sick – are we talking about Lo Pan, the 6-foot roadblock, or the little basket case on wheels?
Right.
You know, but this idea where everything is in a state of spiritual flux, nothing stays the same. It's constantly moving. And because it's constantly moving, it's hard for Burton to pin down – what the heck is going on at any given moment. That last third of the movie, he literally just stands behind the characters and screams things like, what will come out no more?
Right.
What is that? No, don't tell me, you know?
Right, right.
So he is a completely lost in what's happening. And a part of it is because it's constantly changing. It's not a stale, static thing.
Right.
I think that's what you react to as a viewer is there's always something interesting happening, and they're constantly flipping the script. Like I say, Wang is the hero most of the time, but when he's not the hero, sometimes Gracie Law, Kim Cattrall's character, is the hero. And then at other times, you know, Egg Shen comes into the movie very late. Well, he's at the very beginning, but then he comes in late. And he seems like he's the wise old wizard, but as far as I can tell, he just gets everybody high.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty sure. I never really completely grasped that, I think, until the last viewing, that essentially he has a little bit of magic when he fights Lo Pan, but when he's getting Burton and all the guys ready to go fight, I'm pretty sure he just gives them weed. And they're all stoned going down the elevator. He's like, I'm feeling pretty good about myself. I think this is going to go really well. And I think he just gets them all stoned and lets them loose on these various fantasy figures. Let's talk about that scene near the beginning of the movie, because I think it's an interesting encapsulation sort of what we're talking about and what Carpenter's trying to do with the movie, where – and it happens very quickly into the film. After you've got that airport scene where Mao Yin is kidnapped mm-hmm. and it's kind of botched because Burton – I don't know what Burton's – Burton's trying to hit on Kim Cattrall.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, we'll try Stan Dunning Win. It's Miller time, you know. And while that's happening, she's kidnapped, and then he and Don go to rescue her, and they end up with a truck going down this back alley in Chinatown.
Yes.
And suddenly they're in the middle of like a old-fashioned chop-socky turf war.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny because you get, again, like you get that sense that – and I think this is one of the brilliant things that Carpenter does, where Burton never fully understands what's going on, as you said. And I think looking at it through his eyes as the audience and following him as the main character – you never fully know and understand what's going on. And it feels like everyone else does, but you don't. And so he's there with his friend, and they're, you know, driving down with his friend Wang, and they're driving down, you know, and he's just kind of like, what's this? You know, what's going on? Oh, it's a funeral. Okay. And then all of a sudden enter in the, who is it? The Black Hand or
Well, they have the Wing Kong,
yeah,
and then the other name escapes
rival
me.
Gang,
right? And they come out and go, "Who, do these guys have any enemies?" Like, "Oh yeah,"
yeah.
And then they come out, and the guys are like twirling blades,
right,
and stuff like that. And
then you've got, you know, something like almost a pre-equilibrium where, you know, you've got this Mexican guy looking guy, although he's supposed to be Chinese, and he's got the two revolvers, you know,
and then like Gerald Akamura pops up with like a machine,
right,
gun and a big round of ammo, who, you know, it's a Japanese actor, but that's okay. Anyone who watches a lot of these things will recognize him from the G.I. Joe movie, the first one. He was Snake Eyes' mentor.
Oh, yes,
and,
yes.
And so there's a lot of – if you do watch these movies, there's a lot of recognizable faces. It's funny because somebody in our screening was like, "That's Jackie Chan."
Yeah.
It's like – I don't think so, but when,
right,
we looked at the guy, like, I can't remember the guy's name, but when you look at him and Jackie Chan, they basically aged exactly the same. He looks more like Jackie Chan than he did then, and he looks like Jackie Chan. But that point brings up another one, which speaks, I think, to what's going on. Carpenter originally wanted Dunn's character, Wang, mm-hmm, to be played by Jackie Chan.
Yes.
But everyone, the studio was like, which is kind of weird because Dunn's not a name either, but they,
right,
were concerned, I think, about Chan's ability to speak the English dialogue and, mm-hmm, things like that. And so they ultimately didn't go with him. So Chan had his, like, American attempt at an American breakthrough around the same time, that year or the year before, with a movie called The Protector.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was he and Danny Aiello, maybe?
Could be, yeah.
That sounds right. And that wasn't a very good movie. It was, again, a kind of serious movie. It didn't really show off Chan's chops, I think, the way something like Big Trouble in Little China might have.
Yes.
But I think you see this frustration of Carpenter is trying to do what Tarantino comes out and does years later and what the Wachowskis do with The Matrix.
Yes.
I think The Matrix is the movie where they kind of are finally able to convince people that, hey, this world of Chinese martial arts isn't just relegated to bad middle-of-the-day Saturday,
right,
afternoon movies. You know, you killed my master.
Right,
and someone,
right,
beats on a Naugahyde couch with a ping-pong paddle for an hour for sound effects. But those – if you look at a movie like The Matrix, even if you're able to pull away all the sci-fi levels and layers, again, you've got a white dude –
yeah,
who doesn't know what's going on.
And because it's Keanu Reeves, it's a really white dude.
Now he knows Kung Fu.
Right.
Of course, the interesting thing there is he's taught Kung Fu by the African-American character. so it's essentially at the heart of it, you have the same thing. I'm going to go out and say I think Big Trouble in Little China is a better movie than The Matrix.
Yeah.
I think it takes itself less seriously. It is goofy. It doesn't have much of a plot in a sense, which is kind of like we talked – a few weeks ago, I don't know if we were talking about the BFG or what we were talking about. We talked about the sense of something, a movie feeling like a dream, or what that really means for a movie to feel dreamlike.
Yeah.
And I think we discussed how a movie often feels dreamlike. It's something that we can reference, but it's hard to describe what we mean by that. Is it because it feels disconnected? I've watched lots of movies with really bad holes in plots. They don't feel like dreamlike.
Right.
It's when a movie is mostly running, I think, off of emotional energy.
Yes.
Where things feel emotionally true without feeling literally true.
Yes.
Like the emotional vibe of Big Trouble in Little China, which is just a what's next, what's next? Like a kid running around inside a haunted house.
Yes.
Or something. Like I can't ever even get a time frame. Like it seems like everything in Big Trouble in Little China happens within like a 4-hour window of time, because I keep thinking, shouldn't they try to get Mao Yin back? They're hanging out and having noodles, but then,
right,
in the next scene they're like in
his
Lopan's
palace
dungeon, and then they're back at the
noodle.
Every few minutes they're back at the restaurant sitting down and chilling out again, and it's just like, and then suddenly, you know, Burton finds his truck and they escape, and then they just stop at the light, and it's like, it's such a weird moment when they're just stopped, and you hear they're stopped at like a red light for a minute. It's the only time the movie pauses and you're like, okay, all right, we can go on now. Just a strange kind of vibe. We don't see that pacing in movies much anymore because it feels like we're always trying to build and build and build, and then we have to get to the big final set piece. And Big Trouble in China doesn't quite run that way. You know, it has the big confrontation. Though, to be fair, the final battle with Lopan is a little anticlimactic. He just sort of grabs the knife and throws it and just happens to.
Right. Well, and then you have, you know, it's funny because, like, you have the whole scene with Lo Pan and Egg Shen where it's like, you know, virtual reality video.
That's a classic scene. As another, that whole bit at the end, I think, is part of Carpenter's commentary on how we just digest and chew up other cultures, and we spit most of it out. We think we're eating the nutrients, but we're just getting the trash. Because when Burton and all the characters arrive at Lo Pan's his underground lair, we've seen his house with a lot of the beautiful Oriental like architecture and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And today, it just kind of looks like somebody like, you know, like went to like a one of these stores in the mall, like a Bon-Ton or something, and bought all the crap and just put it in there. But there's some interesting imagery, more classical Chinese imagery there in his lair, the above ground lair.
Right.
When you get to the underground, like dark temple,
yeah,
it looks like a strip mall.
Yeah.
Like or more like a food
strip
court.
Club.
Well, a little bit of a strip club mixed with, in the 1980s, that was what the food court would look like.
Yeah.
Because it literally has escalators going up amidst the giant. Then the demon statue has, it's surrounded with neon lighting. And it's literally like, I'm like, that's the mall food court.
Yeah.
Like, that's what we're looking at. And down the side looks again like one of those outdoor strip malls. You're like, what is this? What is he trying to say here? And the characters have fights going up and down those escalators.
Yes.
And then, like you say, when Lo Pan and Egg Shen start to battle, this is a classic image in a lot of fantasy movies where the light side has a force that comes out. You know, much like the lightsaber duels and things like that. There's always a dark force and a light force. And the classic image of the wizard shooting beams at each other. And it's not surprising that these beams take forms of a demonic warrior and a heavenly warrior, a green light and a red light. But then you flash over and Hong has his fingers out like he's tapping like an arcade game. And his thumbs are just going up and down. And Shen is over here like he's turning dials. And it looks like that's what they're having. And of course, this is 86, so arcade would have been jammed right there in the middle of your food court.
Yeah.
Right next to the video store and the Kim's Karate.
That's
so
right.
It's sort of like explaining how these are the boxes we've made for all of this stuff, and it just keeps overflowing out of it. But I think that they do hint at some of this idea. At least as a kid, I remember wanting to read more. Like, I liked Burton, but I wasn't that much concerned about what he did after he drove off. I figured he just went off and did something else.
Right.
I didn't want to see the next story about Jack Burton, to be honest. It wasn't that I didn't like him. I just didn't think much about him, except that when he was on screen. And I think what I was interested in was finding out more about the Chinese mythology, more about the Chinese culture, which I think is exactly what not just Carpenter, but a lot of these other guys were doing. They weren't interested in telling another American action story, but I do think Carpenter is trying to tap into something mythic about American folklore. And going back almost, like Burton in his mind is almost, he's like the, if you think at one point we've got guys like Paul Bunyan, and, you know, but these are characters created by a bunch of itinerant lumberjacks and cowpokes who are creating larger than life versions of themselves. The American dream is always bigger than it really is. And that idea is Burton is the guy who's spinning the legend, you know.
Yes.
He was a hero. He came in and saved us all. And in his mind, he's Paul Bunyan or Pecos Bill or whatever have you. But in reality, he's a lot less.
Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
No, I think what's great about this is some of the other movies we mentioned. You know, we talked about The Princess Bride, Remo Williams, and I agree with you. I think Remo Williams is one of those movies that not many people know about. I think it's a shame because I think it's just another fun action adventure movie in a similar vein to some of the other ones we mentioned. Army of Darkness.
And Remo was a year earlier, actually.
Then. Was it? Okay.
I forgot Wilford Brimley was in it.
Yes. Yes, he was. He was, what was his character's name? Oh, darn it, it's escaping me. But, you know, these are just fun movies that you can get together with people and you have a great time quoting. They're movies that stay with you. And it doesn't matter how many times you've seen them or how many times you haven't seen them. These are just, they're fun party movies. You know, I remember in college we got together and we watched The Princess Bride on the big screen in the chapel and, you know, just... you know, everybody's just quoting that movie. And I think, you know, Big Trouble in Little China, you had a similar sense to that. I think, you know, one of the reasons why people maybe refrain from being as boisterous is because, you know, you are still paying $11 to go see this movie.
They were pretty boisterous.
So, but yeah, they were. They were. I mean, they were still getting into it. People were still quoting lines, you know, and it just, it had that fun, energetic atmosphere.
I'll say this about Big Trouble in Little China. And I think it's true, The Princess Bride, too. But Big Trouble in Little China, what I think I noted, and maybe is what downplayed that party element a little bit, is watching it, you, particularly on the big screen, you remember all the fun stuff, but you have a greater appreciation for the fact that John Carpenter, even though he was working with a lot of, like, he wasn't working with the state of the art almost any time he was doing something. I mean, almost all of his film scores were done on synthesizers, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
But he's a real movie artist. Like, there's a lot of artistry that goes into Big mm-hmm. Trouble in Little China. It has a slapdash feel to the story, but there's a lot of skill in the way shots are framed and things are done and handled, the comic timing with things. I think that you get caught up in that as well. You get mm-hmm. caught up in what's really good filmmaking for the most part. Even the scene towards the beginning when the car is just shooting down towards them in yes. the parking garage.
Yes.
And every scene, there's a kinetic sense. Even though we aren't talking about these greatly – what Carpenter didn't have at the time were these great Chinese choreographers that come along and help do movies like The Matrix and stuff
right.
like that. He didn't have – the resources to stage really elaborate, graceful martial arts scenes. He wanted right. them, so he had to do some interesting filmmaking.
Right.
But to keep referencing back to what is happening to Jack Burton during the big battle, and most of the time, it's like, where's Waldo? You're trying yeah. to find out where he is in his fracas, and 90% of the time, he's laying on the ground. Like, at one right. point, the one guy, he does manage to kill this giant stone guard or whatever. Yeah. He stabs him in the stomach, and he falls on top of him, and he spends the rest of the battle trying to kick him off.
Yes.
But a lot of those scenes, like even like watch it, you get a real sense of the world within the world, like the Chinatown within the American city, the supernatural underground within the Chinatown.
Yeah.
And there's just a great sensibility to it. I think that the way it's made comes off really kind of jokey. Now, I will say a movie like Remo Williams and Buckaroo Banzai, they are kind of shoddy. They are not right. greatly made movies. They feel like they were snapped together on a dime.
Sure.
But I think Big Trouble in Little China has a higher level of quality. That's not just me, the fanboy, mm-hmm. coming to it, but the way all the creatures are handled and introduced
right.
and just even that weird performance that James Hong gives as Lo Pan, where at one point he's this tall, creepy, hopping vampire kind of character,
right.
and then he is the creepy little dude in
right.
the wheelchair. And
indeed,
yes, there's a lot, but there's comic timing that goes on back and forth between the two of them, and it's funny how he plays that character because he doesn't play him like this guy wants to rule the world. He just wants the girl. Like,
right.
It's really kind of like he's just like the bonus is I get to live forever,
right?
And Kurt Russell almost can't help but make fun of him.
Right.
For it. He's kind of like, you're not going to get her.
Right.
What are you thinking? Like, he doesn't care about the end of the world stuff. He's like, you can't get the girl
right.
slot. That's not how it should be. He can't fathom it at
right.
all, but he's consistently through the movie. And it's clear that towards the end, all he wants to do is kill Kim Cattrall's character so he can keep the other one.
Right, right. Oh, man. That's great. Well, we are running down on time here, so.
But I do have to point
yeah.
this out. I literally just saw it. So, Boom Comics, which does various like comic book iterations of like movie characters and things like that,
mm-hmm.
for the 30th anniversary, they're doing a Big Trouble in Little China crossover where somehow Jack Burton gets transported to to a futuristic world of 1997 where he encounters Snake Plissken and they go on some sort of adventure together. I'm trying to figure out what that's called right now, but I'm sure that will be great, and that's something to look for in your comic book shop.
That's awesome. All right, folks, we're going to go ahead. We're going to sign off now, and we'll catch you all later.
Really shook the pillars of heaven, didn't we, Wang?